Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Sports Inquirer Podcast. This is your host, E. Marcel Portsuit. Hope all of you had a good weekend out there, had a jam-packed weekend of sports out there. We're going to recap UFC on Fox 7, which took place on Saturday in San Jose, California. Going to review all the NBA playoff action. We had 8 games this weekend. All the series started off, all the game ones, so we're going to talk about that. NFL news and notes, draft coming up this week. We're going to delve into that a little bit more. Going to talk some boxing as well. Had a lot of interesting boxing contests over the weekend as well. And finally, I'm not going to do a ruffle my feathers edition today. What I'm going to do is actually talk about teams that have no excuses. And it's going to make some sense when we get to the end of that. But first, some housekeeping issues as usual. Once again, this show is brought to you by thesportsinquirer.net, the premier site for news and notes in the world of sports. Going to have some reviews of the UFC on Fox event, have a write-up on that. The MLB Power Rankings are debuting as well. Looking forward to writing that up and discussing that. And also an analysis of the draft at the end of the week. So a lot of exciting content on thesportsinquirer.net. Also working with thestartinglineup.net, the starting lineup, T-H-E, and then starting lineup, based out of Chicago. As I stated in my last podcast, really excited about doing some work with them in the beginning of May. So looking forward to working with them. So go ahead and check that site out for some archived shows that have been done in the past as well. If you want to send us some information or to contact us, you can always go to our Twitter site, which is Sports Inquirer. Also send us an email at sportsinquirer@gmail.com. And finally, subscribe to us on iTunes. You can, and I check every time, make sure all of my new episodes are up, and they definitely do upload every time I log on to my iTunes. I'm listening to other podcasts such as Joe Rogan's, Aisha Tyler's, a bunch of others, Bert Kreischer, a lot of guys that and people that I'm into. Whenever I download their episodes and their shows, Sports Inquirer and downloads as well. So make sure that you go on there as well and subscribe to us, and you'll get all of our archived episodes. But when we come back, we are going to review all of the action that took place at UFC on Fox 7 here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. I think it's kind of appropriate that I played Fedor's music, Fedor Emelianenko's theme song, or his walkout song, entrance theme, before my analysis of UFC on Fox 7, because he was probably the last elite fighter to spend his entire career at a high level and never officially fight in the UFC. And that mantle was to Gilbert Melendez until this past Saturday. And Eddie Alvarez is now the owner of that crown. But I thought it was appropriate that I play Fedor as far as someone who's never fought in the UFC. And now another person, Melendez, has finally done it. By the way, interesting doing these shows in the morning. We're switching it up this week and we'll try something new. Usually when I record these shows, and all of you out there who are fans and listen, we appreciate it here at the Inquirer. We usually record these in the evening, you know, put them up, and then a lot of you, I think, listen to them in the morning on your way to work or at your job or working out, things like that. Switching it up this week because we have so much action going on during the evening, especially with the NBA playoffs starting up and NHL starting up in the next few weeks as well, and Major League Baseball action. Going to try to record these in the morning, and from there, hopefully by the time around 11 or 12 o'clock in the around that time, Eastern Standard Time, you'll have the episodes on your computer and you'll be able to take care of it and listen to us. So switching it up, definitely a different change of pace. You know, I joke about drinking a tea every time I do an episode. I'm finally drinking tea at an appropriate time. Usually I'm drinking tea at 5 or 6 p.m., but now we're taking care of it a little earlier. But anyway, back to the fights themselves. Learned several things from UFC on Fox 7. First thing I learned is never leave the fight to the judges. And obviously that refers to the main event between Benson Henderson and Gilbert Melendez. With the it's interesting the different technique as far as your scoring goes. If I looked at the fight as round to round, if I did score it round to round, I gave the advantage to Benson Henderson 3-2 as far as individually goes. I thought he was more aggressive. He used more strikes and landed more power kicks and power punches and was able to keep the fight standing up and used all of those advantages to earn the victory. However, I can definitely understand the argument for Melendez earning the win. If you looked at the end of the fight and looked at the grand scope of things, and I think that's where on Twitter you saw a battle between that as far as people who looked at each round individually, I think you gave it to Henderson. But at the end of the fight, if you looked at the overall grand scheme, you said, you know what, I think Gil Melendez had more took advantage of some more opportunities there and got the win. The reality was, is I thought Melendez had plenty of opportunities to take the fight from Henderson. Henderson had an excellent fight, defended his championship, but I thought that Melendez did not take advantage of the vulnerabilities of Henderson. I thought there was a chance for him to maybe get some more ground attacks down and get him on the ground. If you've seen Henderson's past few fights, they stand up. He likes to use his kicking skills, especially, or his kickboxing. But if he was able to maybe get him down a little more often, I think that could have helped out a little bit more as far as getting some takedowns and scoring from there. In the end, Henderson got the victory and kept his belt. Another thing I saw on the Twitter as well, I saw from a few people saying they gave each round to Henderson because he's the champ and to win the round, you have to take it to the champ. You have to be decisive about it. I've never understood that logic personally. And I think we saw a lot of that, especially during the Frankie Edgar, Benson Henderson, the first fight, when there was some closely contested rounds. And a lot of people said, oh, Edgar won it because he's a champ and Henderson didn't take it from him. I don't like that thinking. I don't like that logic, especially in mixed martial arts. I think what you have to do is look at each fight individually and look at each round individually. And you have to look at it as two individuals in the fight. There's no champion. It's just two men or women going at it. And if you go by that theory, I think that's where you would see Melendez deserving a little bit more credit for the fight than a lot of people are giving him, you know, during the contest. And we'll see what happens next with that fight. I'd love to see a rematch. I think we're going to see a rematch coming up. What's probably going to happen is Henderson, he'll probably fight the winner of the Gray Maynard has a big fight coming up. I think it's TJ Grant. The winner of that fight's going to fight Henderson, probably end of the year. There's plenty of options for Melendez finally in the lightweight division that he can fight. Obviously, the only guy he probably won't fight is going to be Nate Diaz. Obviously, they have a strong relationship. Even though looking at the periphery of things overall, that would be a pretty good opponent for him. But I don't think that's happening, and Diaz has his own issues, and we'll get to that a little later. But good win by Henderson. Nice little proposal at the end for his girlfriend. Live proposals are always dicey. I thought it was a WWE crowd, back to my boys in wrestling, booing a proposal. Usually you only hear booing in a ring as far as love goes during a proposal or a marriage or a wedding ceremony, things like that. So dicey move by Henderson, but she said yes, so all is well for him. Next thing I learned is Daniel Cormier has an interesting decision to make. He looked good in his victory over Frank Mir and in the heavyweight division. Was able to control the pace of the fight using his, I think, Greco-wrestling skills. Was able to get Mir against the cage, use some uppercuts, use some dirty boxing, as the term goes. Did not take him down. I was surprised that Cormier didn't take down Mir more often. I guess he feared the submission skills of Mir, and Mir still, even to this day, is probably the top submission guy in the heavyweight division. So I guess Cormier was trying to avoid getting into that trap. But for Cormier, he's strong. The big debate is, for those of you unfamiliar with it, he's debating to go between heavyweight division and the light heavyweight division. He's a small heavyweight. He's 220 pounds, 230 pounds, which is a big man. But for the heavyweight division where guys are cutting down to 265 pounds, he is a substantial size disadvantage. Even though Frank Mir came into the fight around 250 and looked very good, looked very healthy, 250, and Cormier was able to have a nice strength advantage there, I think he's going to run into trouble if he moves up the ladder facing the Alistair Overeems and Antonio Bigfoot Silvas, and of course the champ Cain Velasquez. And obviously him facing Cain Velasquez looks like it's going to be a tough decision because they're both training partners and all that stuff. So he'd be strong for a light heavyweight if he cut down the weight. The problem with it, though, is the last time that he cut weight in a substantial manner was back in 2008 when he was a representative for the United States in the Olympics, and he literally almost died trying to cut the weight down to that level to compete at the Olympics. So it's definitely something he has to consider as far as a lifestyle choice, because mixed martial arts is important, but it's not the most important thing. You know, he has a life to live, he has a family to raise. So he needs to make a decision as far as, and he did say during the post-fight presser that if he does move down to 205 pounds, he'll need some time to get to that, probably 6 to 8 months, so he can prepare himself for it. Obviously, I think all of the signs are him moving down to light heavyweight. I mean, when you have Dana White pretty much indicating that during the presser, and Cormier talking so openly about it, it's going to have to happen at this point. Because, one, it would look bad as far as PR goes and just personality-wise. But, two, he does avoid Cain Velasquez. And, obviously, if you want to fight at the highest level, you got to face a champ. And Velasquez is going nowhere. And Cormier and Velasquez seem like they don't want to fight. So, I think we're going to see him move down to 205. But that may mean we don't see him for a while. But Cormier, good win for him. Nice debut in the UFC. Next thing I learned was a rough night for the Scrap Pack. A Scrap Pack consists of four major fighters: Nate Diaz, Gil Melendez, Nick Diaz, and Jake Shields. Obviously, Gil Melendez, we talked about his loss. Nick Diaz just coming off his defeat to George St. Pierre for the welterweight crown in UFC. Nate Diaz had a rough night of it as well. Tough loss to Josh Thompson. I thought that Diaz, I don't know if it's the focus or, I think it was focus, and the reason I say that is the thing I did not like hearing is during the pre, and I try not to be a big body language guy or read too much into the words of the fighters before they go into the contest, but when Nate Diaz spent more time talking about how much he likes Gil Melendez and how he wants to move to the welterweight division and saying all of this stuff before he fought Josh Thompson, that was not I did not get a good vibe about that. And you saw that. Thompson, not much bigger than Diaz. In fact, Diaz really should have a size advantage in the lightweight division, the 155-pound class. But you saw Thompson take advantage numerous times of his strength. And I don't know if Diaz was out of it. And even just once they got the body blows, that was just too much for Diaz to handle. So he has to make some decisions as well as far as where he is going to go. And the last thing I learned, or second to last thing, tremendous night for knockouts. I think there were 8 knockouts or TKOs in the card, which tied the record for the most in the UFC card since UFC 90-something or 80-something. But it's been a long time. Impressed by Matt Brown's TKO of Jordan Mean. Matt Brown's an interesting prospect. I know he's a little bit older to be considered a prospect, but that was an impressive stoppage by him in the Fox card. Chad Mendez, excellent win over Darren Elkins. Mendez looked like he's moving up the charts once again to get a shot at the title. Interesting to see what he can do maybe against Aldo or maybe even against Barao if it goes down another weight class. But Mendez continues to represent Team Alpha Male well and move it up. Finally, Miles Jury, that straight punch knockout of Ramzi Najim. I suggest you look that up on YouTube. That was it's hard to knock out someone with a straight jab up the middle. 99% of the time, if you see a knockout, it's whether with a hook or an uppercut. But he just had a straight jab, and Ramzi Nagym was out before he even hit the ground. That was incredible. Joseph Benavidez using good body blows to knock out Darren Uranyama. Hope I said that right. Biggest thing with that is I'm glad to see fighters, and I talked about it with Josh Thompson, starting to use body blows, and at least as punches go, and starting to take advantage of that. I think you can continue to see the evolution of mixed martial arts. And even going full circle, even with Benson Henderson, he's really taking advantage of the body kicks, or using the low kicks, not only to the legs, but to the body. And you're seeing guys like him, and I said Benavidez got a knockout by a body punch to the ground, or a body punch to Darren, and got the knockout. So that was a good move by him, and continue to see the evolution of the sport. And one more highlight reel, we had Yoel Palacio with a flying knee knockout of Clifford Starks. Another highlight reel. Really good to see, and it's good for the sport overall as well. I appreciate a good ground game, a good scrap. I like submissions. Honestly, I appreciate the subtleties of a submission attempt more than a straight knockout, but that's just me. Maybe that's jiu-jitsu fan in me. But I think it's good to have all those knockouts for the crowd to see and for the fans to witness. And then finally, Fox continued to implement their UFC MMA into their plans. Obviously, it's the 7th UFC on Fox. I still remember where I was for the first one when Cain Velasquez lost his belt to Junior Dos Santos, and there was only one fight on the card, or at least that was televised on Fox. Now you have, I think there were four fights. Yes, there were four that were on Fox for this past event on Saturday. Well, Fox Sports 1, we talked about it a few weeks ago with the announcement of that new station. The UFC and mixed martial arts overall is going to have a major part in that on that channel. They're going right after ESPN and trying to go after that younger demographic. And I think that mixed martial arts is going to be a big part of it, including Ultimate Fighter now being on Fox Sports 1. I don't think it was a coincidence that Ronda Rousey on the Sprint phone or T-Mobile One or whatever you call it did an interview on the fight card. You also had Chael Sonnen, who does the show on Fuel. I guess they have like a weekly MMA show or UFC show on there. He was one of the analysts. Kenny Florian as well. I think you're starting to see that Fox is making a big stranglehold with UFC and partnering up and making a major move. And anytime there are free fights on TV, I'm always happy. As I said, you can never complain about a free fight card on TV. You may be disappointed in a fight or two, or maybe you want to see a little bit more, but you can't complain about it and say, oh, this was terrible, because you got to see some fights on TV for free, so no complaints there. So those are my thoughts on UFC Fox 7 that just took place on Saturday. I'm going to take a break here, and when I come back, I'm going to review all the action that took place in the NBA playoffs over the weekend here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. I go through music phases, and I think we're going to go into a prog rock phase here. Interestingly enough, if you've been listening to this show for the past few weeks, I've done a lot of instrumental hip-hop, and my rap heads out there, my hip-hop peeps, we're going to keep that going, of course. But I go through phases, and right now I think we're going to hear a lot of Genesis and Yes, and some Rush as well coming up over the next few podcasts. As I go through phases with my music, and I think I'm out of my hip-hop one for a little bit, and we're going to go there. So that was some Chris Squire for you. NBA playoffs started off this weekend, favorite time of the year. As I always say, with NBA playoffs, NHL is going to get started up in a week or two. Major League Baseball in full swing, even some auto racing. MMA goes on forever, all year. So I love this time of year in the spring. You can keep your summers and keep your winters. Give me the late spring and early fall all day. Let's see, playoffs, a lot of action there. Knicks, I learned a lot of things in the playoffs as well. Knicks defense looks the part. They won their first game against the Boston Celtics 85-78. Carmelo Anthony had 36 points. Really looks really good there. Biggest thing, though, with the Knicks, and I said I watch a lot of their games as a fan, and just Knicks are always a polarizing team and on national TV quite a bit, so you get to see a lot of their games. The biggest thing with them has always been the defense. Offensively, they pass the ball well when Anthony's not holding it on to it too long, but they do a good job of shooting a lot of three-pointers, getting the efficiency going. But the defense is always their problem. And I thought they'd be in trouble when Boston held the 70-63 lead late in the third quarter. But between the Celtics' turnovers, which I think was caused a lot by the Knicks' defensive effort, between the perimeter defense of Jason Kidd and the interior of Kenyon Martin, they are able to outscore the Celtics 21-8 for the rest of the game. Now, if you told me that, I would be relying as a fan on Jason Kidd and Kenyon Martin getting crunch time minutes at the end of the game. I would be very, in the beginning of the season, I'd have been very pessimistic about that. But they have really done a good job of showing that veteran leadership. And it's interesting to see what happens in the rest of the series. Kidd looks like he's right, and him and Felton, good backcourt. J.R. Smith, he does his thing. He's really showed a lot of maturity. The Tyson Chandler and Kenyon Martin dynamic, I'm really intrigued by. Tyson Chandler actually played less minutes than Kenyon Martin, who was not even on the team a few months ago. I'm interested to see what Mike Woodson does with that as far as the interior defense, because Martin looks like he's able to give him a little bit more offensively than Chandler does as far as the inside. Obviously, the offense of the Knicks rides or dies with Carmelo Anthony, but and the three-pointers by the rest of the squad. But I'm interested to see what happens the rest of that series. So Knicks looked good defensively in the first game of that series. I still think it's going to be a long series. It may even go seven. The Nets looked intriguing in their 106-88 win over Chicago. We've talked about who can beat the Heat in the playoffs as far as in the Eastern Conference. I think we see some viable contenders in the West. But as far as the Eastern Conference, we've talked about the Pacers a lot. For good reason. They have a good blueprint to beat the Miami Heat, maybe for a game or two, maybe make a series of it. I say look out for the Nets as well. The two biggest things that the Heat struggle with are inside play and strong guard perimeter play. Let me explain myself with that and how the Nets can intrigue with that. Brook Lopez, arguably the best center in the East, maybe in all of the NBA, at least as far as play this season, he scored 21 points in the victory over Chicago in Game 1. The one thing that he struggled with, more than anything, is inside presence by the opponent. You've seen the Bulls give him trouble with Joakim Noah when he's right, and the Bulls always give the Heat troubles. Roy Hibbert, even David West for the Pacers, give Miami struggles, because outside of Chris Bosh, there really isn't strong post play. And I love Chris Birdman. I love him as a fan of the NBA and seeing him play. And he's really been a good solid contributor for them. He's still limited skill-wise. Joel Anthony, similar as well. So Brook Lopez scoring 21 points in the first game, that's good. Deron Williams has returned to all-star form as well. He had 22 points in the victory. If they can get a good backcourt play between Deron Williams and even Joe Johnson, who had a quiet double-digit scoring night as well for the Nets, they'll be the next opponent for the Heat, who I think we all know are going to get past Milwaukee pretty easily. We could see a game six if the Nets get past Chicago. If the Nets get to play the Miami Heat, we can definitely see a six-game series as far as that goes. For the Bulls, similar to the Lakers, who only scored 79 points in their loss to San Antonio last night, if you can't score, you're not going to win in the postseason. And the Bulls and the Lakers are so limited offensively. The Lakers, without Kobe Bryant, lack a lot of scoring. While Howard gives you some moments on defense, offensively he's still limited. And Paul Gasol, I don't think he's just right overall. So the Lakers are in definite trouble against the Spurs, who looked good in their win. You saw an announcement of some presences for a new player and an older player in two of the games. Paul George, who to a lot of non-hardcore NBA fans not familiar with his game, he had a triple-double, 23 points, 12 rebounds, 11 assists in the 107-90 win over the Atlanta Hawks. He's arguably one of the most improved players in all of the NBA. Young guy. I think we're going to start to see him, especially with the missing of Danny Granger from the Pacers. He is going to be the offensive force for the Pacers as they continue on into the playoffs. And Andre Miller, with a game-high 28 points off the bench for Denver's 97-95 win over the Golden State Warriors, had that late layup with about 2 seconds left in the contest. The Ty Lawson, Andre Miller combo point guard grouping has been outstanding all season. But I just don't understand what the Warriors, and you saw their inexperience, and you saw an experience with Milwaukee and Houston as well in their first games, but definitely with the Warriors. Got a late three-pointer from Seth Curry to tie the game, and you expected it to go to overtime. There's no excuse to allow Andre Miller to drive to the basket and get an open layup with 3 seconds left in the contest. He's been using the same move since he was at Utah 15 years ago. I was joking with one of my followers on Twitter, or actually a good college buddy of mine, Adrian, and he's like, he's been using that old man moves for like 13 years, and I told him, no, he's been using it since Utah, since he was in college. So I don't understand how they allowed that to happen, that late layup to get the win. So that was a good win for the Nuggets, who actually are going to get Kenneth Faried back. We'll talk about the injuries in a moment, but injuries are starting to play a major role in these playoffs. Before we get to that, just one last thing as far as inexperience. You saw the Bucks and the Rockets, two younger teams, especially with the Rockets, guys who are making their first playoff appearances. You saw the inexperience come into form. The Bucks actually were competitive for a half. I'll give them credit. And I like Brandon Jennings saying that the Bucks are going to beat the Heat in six. What was he supposed to say? He's supposed to say, no, we're going to just show up to Miami and get destroyed and get swept and my season's going to be over. He should expect the win. I'm a competitor. We're all competitors in our various forms of life. We want to be the best at it. I would hope so. Or at least be competitive. I don't think you're going to walk into a gym and say, yeah, we're going to lose. So I like his aggressiveness as far as predicting the victory. We all know it's not going to happen, but hey, you know, respect to him for at least putting it out there. And he looked good for a half, but Miami, they just wear on you. And if the Bucks aren't making their three-pointers, if Monty Ellis and J.J. Redick aren't hitting a lot of three-pointers, they're going to be in trouble, and they were last night. You saw that happen. The Rockets, just too many turnovers. You saw some, and I don't want to put the loss all on Jeremy Lin. I think it was a little harsh, the TNT crew at halftime. You saw them analyze the struggles of Jeremy Lin in the first half against Oklahoma City. I think you just saw a lot of rushed play by the Rockets. And those of you out there saying, well, that's the way that they play, that's their style. They like to shoot a lot of three-pointers, made the most three-pointers in the entire league as a team. While that's true, you still have to be controlled about it. And I think that you also saw the Thunder show good balance as well. Russell Westbrook looked like he was very controlled. He gets a lot of flack for his overly aggressive play. He looked good in the contest. I don't think that's going to be a sweep, but it's going to be very tough for me to see Houston winning that series. And finally, the last thing I learned from the NBA playoffs this past weekend, injuries are going to continue to play a major role in this. We've already seen injuries play a factor in guys who aren't even in the playoffs in their respective teams. Derrick Rose being the most obvious case all season with the Bulls. Kobe Bryant being out for the Lakers with the torn Achilles. I don't think Joakim Noah is completely healthy for the Bulls. He's dealing with the plantar fasciitis. And you saw him struggle, I think, at times, even to run up and down the court against the Nets. He's a gamer. He's going to try hard. But if he's not able to show his activity, his normal aggressiveness, Brook Lopez is going to eat them up the entire series. And you saw that last night. Really hurt to see David Lee out with a torn right hip flexor for Golden State. Warriors have been a fun team to watch all year. David Lee, double-double machine, had the most in the NBA this year. Him being out for the entire playoffs is going to really seal the fate for the Warriors. They're already going to struggle facing the Nuggets, who have a deeper team and have the home court advantage. It's going to be really tough for the Warriors to get past the Nuggets right now, especially with Kenneth Faried coming back for the Nuggets. That's going to be really tough for them. And finally, Kobe Bryant. I thought it was really interesting seeing the interaction between the tweets that he was doing throughout the entire contest, the game against the Spurs last night, and the broadcasters, or ABC, posting them throughout the game. Kobe Bryant may be the only player in the NBA that could get away with that as far as putting posts up about the team during the game, saying that he texted Paul Gasol to go and like post, and them and ABC actually acknowledging it. I think we're going to start seeing some more of it. While you have teams, you have like the NFL, and it's interesting seeing the Twitter policy. Like NFL, you can't tweet during a game. I guess if you're participating in it, they have a rule against it. You have the NBA actually seems like embracing it, and that's where you see the NBA has always been a leader in social media and digital technology when it comes to interaction between the fans, the broadcasters, and the actual game itself. So I thought it was good seeing all the tweets that Kobe Bryant was doing during the game and the advice he was giving to his teammates and saying that we need to do better things on offensive and defensive ends throughout the entire game and seeing the tweets. We haven't seen this 20 years ago. If anything, you probably would have maybe seen something in the paper the next day about what Bryant was doing. But you saw that direct interaction during the contest. You could have gone on to his Twitter feed and watched the game with him. And I said, I think Bryant's the only guy who get away with that as far as critiquing his teammates while they're out on the court in a playoff game while he's injured and knowing having a big stink about it. So I think we're going to start seeing more of that. I hope we see more of it overall. I love seeing the social media being taken advantage of by players and them having a voice in what we see as fans. And it's good to see Bryant having a moment to step back and being an actual fan as well and us seeing all that stuff. So those are my thoughts on the NBA playoffs so far. We got two games coming up tonight. Let's see, what do we have? I had it up. I know what they are. We have Memphis and the Clippers. And in that contest, Clippers looked really good. Zach Randolph, another guy, I guess, who I don't know if he's necessarily injured, but I stated in the preview of that series, if he's not 100% and not completely right, it's going to be a tough series for the Grizzlies, who already have a weaker bench than the Clippers and aren't able to take advantage of their inside. The biggest advantage the Grizzlies have usually is the Twin Tower combination of Marc Gasol and Zach Randolph. And if Randolph isn't completely right, that's not going to be good for them. And then the second game is the Bulls and the Nets, and I think we covered enough of that. So we're going to take our next break here. When I come back, we're going to talk about some news and notes from the world of the NFL and even get into some draft talk here on the Sports Inquirer podcast.
Yeah.
big week in the world of the NFL. The NFL draft first round starts on Thursday. Really excited about that. Spoke to the Condor. We're going to have a little bit of a draft viewing party over at his place on Thursday night for the first round. And then second and third rounds are on Friday. And rounds 4 through 7 are on Sunday. Or Saturday. Wow, we need to get that correct. All right, let's go over that again. The first round is on Thursday night. Second and third round is on Friday. And then rounds 4 through 7 are on Saturday. There we go. All right, so looking forward to the NFL draft coming up, definitely. Some news and notes from the world of NFL. Darrell Revis, that trade finally happened. He's going to be going to the Tampa Bay Bucks. The Jets get the 13th overall pick in this year's draft, plus conditional third-round pick in 2014. I thought the Jets did pretty well. Well, actually, and then Darrell Revis, what happened? So Revis is now a Tampa Bay Buck. He signed a 6-year, $96 million deal with the Bucks, non-guaranteed money. So he is not guaranteed to see a dime of that until, I guess, he meets some physical incentives and playing incentives, which is really important because he's coming off a torn ACL, which he suffered last season. I think for all things considered with what the Jets had to do and all of the rumors, they did a really good job. They get a top 15 pick in the NFL draft, which is always good. Even in this draft where people are talking bad about what's available and saying it's not a star-studded draft, he's still in the top 15. That's going to be a good pick for them. Really help out that defensive side and help out with picks overall. The Jets, arguably, maybe outside of Jackson, will have the worst roster, I think, player for player in all of the NFL. And I think if you need to really overhaul that entire roster. I'm not going to get into the quarterback play with Mark Sanchez and what they need to do there. I think it's pretty obvious they need to make some changes there. But as far as the rest of the team, I think that the whole Mark Sanchez, Tim Tebow, ineffective quarterback play has really overshadowed the fact that the roster over the past 2-3 seasons for the Jets, even on the defensive end where they took some pride under Rex Ryan, has really regressed and become below average by the NFL standards. So with that pick and then the other picks that they have, 2 first-round picks, I believe, this year that they're going to have, they can really address some major holes on the entire roster. And even with Darrell Revis, if they had him, yes, Revis, when healthy, is the best cornerback in the NFL. That's really not going to help them win games overall. Or Revis is a really good piece if you're like a borderline playoff team looking to make the playoffs and have an impact in the postseason. The Jets aren't even close to that. The Jets have, I think they have a 3-4 win roster on there right now. And Revis is not going to help that cause. So you go from 3 wins to 5 wins. That's not really good enough overall. So good move by them to trade Revis for the Bucks. Really good move for them because they are in a division with 3 Pro Bowl caliber quarterbacks that they have to deal with Matt Ryan here in Atlanta, Cam Newton, obviously, in Carolina, and Josh Freeman's quarterback for Tampa, Drew Brees for the New Orleans Saints. All three guys have made the playoffs, and Cam hasn't made the postseason yet, but he has the ability to definitely be a postseason quarterback. You have to deal with those guys 6 games a year. You need help on your pass defense, which was the worst in the NFL last season, gave up close to 300 yards per game of passing. That's not going to work in this day and age in the NFL. So that was good for the Bucks to do that. And finally, I was really surprised to see, I'm not surprised by the money of the deal, $60 or $96 million. Non-guaranteed, really savvy move by the Bucks to not guarantee money to a man coming off a torn ACL in a premier position that he obviously is going to need a healthy knee to perform. Obviously, the thing about Revis, the past few seasons, he's always threatened to hold out and been unhappy with the money. So you can throw that olive branch at him as far as the financial amount. If he meets the incentives, I believe there'll probably be some physicals and playing a certain amount of games. He'll be the highest paid defensive guy, but definitely defensive back in NFL history and right up there all time as far as financially. So we can't complain about the money. He gets a new scene. Gets to be in a organization. I think that's on the up and up. So I think it's a good win for all parties involved. We just need to see if he gets healthy and makes that happen. James Harrison signed a 2-year deal with the Bengals. Really low risk, good move by the Bengals, in my opinion. Harrison, a former NFL Defensive Player of the Year, Super Bowl champion, really had a rough few years staying on the field health-wise. We all know about the fines and the physical hits that he's put on players over the past few seasons, but he struggled to even stay on the field. If he can stay on the field and be a solid leader for the Steelers, that's a really good move for the Bengals, who have quietly made the playoffs the last two seasons, have lost to the Texans both of those seasons, but you look at it, they have a good quarterback. I'm not going to say a franchise quarterback in Andy Dalton, but a really good player. A.J. Green, who I think has a chance to be the best receiver in all the NFL. And a solid defense that can always use an additional piece. So I like that move for the Bengals. Even if you could use him down for rush, third down pass rush situations. We all know that he can rush the quarterback. So good move for them. And just looking at the draft overall, it's really tough to make an analysis of the draft without seeing where teams will pick. I mean, we know where teams are picking. But I think outside of Kansas City at number one, who I think we all know are going to take offensive linemen, whether it's Luke Jokel or Eric Fisher, I think it's a very fluid situation as far as who is going to be taken. For two reasons. One, with the new salary cap or the new salary structure for rookies, the rookie cap, if you want to call it that, the financial commitment is not as much as it used to be. So that's where you're starting to see teams more willing to make trades, moving up and down as far as the draft board goes. And secondly, with the lack of an elite quarterback or even an elite wide receiver, really, or pass rusher in this draft, you're going to see teams fall in love with certain linemen that may surprise you. Prime example, I'm just looking at the board right now. Say that let's say Detroit's at 5 right now, and the Cardinals really like Luke Jokel. That's the guy, and he's at number 5, or Eric Fisher. And the Cardinals are at 7, and that's who they really want. They don't want to stick with the Chance Lomack, Warmack, or a Lane Johnson, or even a Jonathan Cooper, and they really want to get Jokel, but they fear that the Chargers at 6 are going to take him. That's where you're really going to see the Cardinals make a move with the Lions at 5 and get Jokel. But honestly, what's the difference between a Jokel or a Warmack, or even a Jokel and Eric Fisher on the offensive end, or even a Cooper, or even going down the line, you just see a lot of these other guys as far as the old linemen go. What I'm trying to say is that it's going to be very individualized, where one team may like Jokel a lot, they're not going to like Fisher. And one team may think Lane Johnson from Oklahoma is going to be the best tackle in the entire draft, and they see him there and they're ready to make a move. Or Chance Warmack, who is really making a big move as a guard. I think you're going to see a lot of fluidity on the offensive side of the ball as far as trades go because of that. As far as the quarterbacks go, Geno Smith, Matt Barkley, I would say if you're in the middle of the first round, I say why not take Geno Smith? The problem I have is, the last 2 years, and I will go down fighting with these, I did not think Blaine Gabbert was even a first-round pick. I don't know why the Jaguars took him. He was not a first-rounder. And obviously you've seen he's been terrible. And I don't care about all the optimism and he's looked good in practice. He has been a borderline disaster for the Jaguars entering his third season. And the other one is Ryan Tannehill. I guess they had with Mike Sherman going down to Miami and taking his former college quarterback, I did not like him even being a first rounder either. And we're going to see in all these mock drafts, we're going to see a move up by one of these guys. Geno Smith, I think, is going to be a first rounder. We have that. Matt Barkley is going to be a first rounder as well. I don't care what anyone says. That's just the way quarterbacks go. Ryan Deceived, a quarterback out of Syracuse. He's going to be taken in the first round as well. There's going to be a team late in there, like a St. Louis or a Denver. They're going to take him late in the first round, just, I guess, have some security around and figure it out. So Geno Smith I like as a first-round grade. Really good arm, really accurate. I know he had some struggles at the end of the season in West Virginia, but I like him as a first-round quarterback. All the other ones, I'm not so sure about. Tavon Austin, as far as offensive guys, I really like him. He's a very dynamic receiver. Really, can you play that Percy Harvin role as far as being a good receiver, return man, even use some split-back situations? I really like his versatility on offense. As far as the receivers go, besides Austin, Cordell Patterson, saw him play up close at the Chick-fil-A Kickoff Classic when Tennessee played North Carolina State. Was really impressed to see him on the field. I think he's going to be a really good NFL receiver. I would make a first-round grade for him as well. I really like his skills overall. But the rest of the draft, honestly, and we'll talk about the defense probably in tomorrow's show or Wednesday's, really, it's a defensive draft. If you like defense and you like O-linemen, this is the draft for you. Not like last year where we had the list of quarterbacks, the three franchise guys you saw in Robert Griffin III, Andrew Luck, and even Russell Wilson in the third round, and Tannehill and Brandon Wheaton getting in the first round as well. We're not going to see that in this year's draft. So if you're looking, as I said, if you like linemen and you like defense, this is a draft for you. So the big uglies are going to get their moment to shine in the draft. We're going to take our last break here, and when we come back, I'm going to talk about some boxing that I saw over the weekend, and then get into my latest edition of what didn't ruffle my feathers, or what has ruffled my feathers. We'll figure it out as we go along on Teams That Have No Excuses here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. Show, obviously, want to remind you once again for all the news and notes in the world of sports to head over to the sportsinquirer.net. We always have some updates. Turn the mic up. There we go. All right. So once again, as I was saying, always for all the news and notes in the world of sports, go over to the sportsinquirer.net. We'll have a lot of content up for you. And hit us up on Twitter under Sports Inquirer. And then finally, subscribe to us on iTunes under the Sports Inquirer. And you can get all of our updated shows as it happens, as well as getting our archived events as well. So while we've talked about a lot of mixed martial arts and football and NBA playoffs, there was two interesting fights that were on TV as well this past weekend. I don't know why boxing decided to do it on this weekend and not next weekend when you have the UFC on Fox event start NBA playoffs. But we had two good contests. Tyson Fury, the heavyweight prospect out of Great Britain that is getting a lot of pub in the world of boxing, defeated Steve Cunningham by knockout. The fight actually took place at Madison Square Garden, was on NBC on the afternoon. Not impressed with Fury overall. I think he's a solid puncher. He's got the size, big guy. I think he's 6'8 or 6'9. So he's got the size to compete at the heavyweight level, which unfortunately, has become a requirement to fight in that division with Vitaly and Wladimir Klitschko and their height and size. I thought there were moments where Cunningham had him in trouble, and Cunningham even got a knockout of Fury in the second round. But in the end, Fury was able to get a knockout of his own, I think in the seventh round, and get the victory. As I said, I'm not going to complain about a free fight on television. I knew of the fight. I thought it was going to be pay-per-view or on one of the pay channels as far as Showtime or HBO. But I was flipping the channels and saw the fight starting. I was like, oh, it's on NBC. So NBC, they're trying to make their mark and trying to get the boxing. And they do a pretty good job of boxing, I think, overall. You see a lot of fights on NBC Sports Network. They have a Friday night or a Saturday night event they have going on. So you see a lot of that stuff. And now I'll say it once and I'll say it again. While I've watched more mixed martial arts lately, I will always have respect for boxing. That's a sport I grew up on. And I'll never make a choice of, you gotta choose one or the other. That's stupid. They're two different sports, two different disciplines, and I'll continue to watch both of them. So I never get into that war of boxing fans or MMA fans talking bad about the other one. I'll never do that. I like them both. And then the other fight was Saul Canelo Alvarez won a decision over Austin Trout on Showtime. Actually did not witness this fight, so I really don't have much analysis of it. I'll be honest with you. Always keep it real here on the podcast. I do have it archived, though. It was on Showtime, so I'll probably watch it later on this week. And after that, maybe I'll do some analysis of it after I see the fight. But Canelo Alvarez, major Mexican prospect as well, young guy. Interesting to see Fury and Alvarez, both guys under the age of 25, trying to make their name in the sport. Both have unique qualities about them. Fury, obviously named after Mike Tyson, that doesn't hurt the box office. Real big talker, has openly talked about fighting the Klitschkos and being real aggressive with them. Obviously being a white heavyweight is always interesting visually for a lot of people. Being European is always a selling point as well. So we'll see what happens there. Canelo Alvarez being Mexican. And we can go with the, if you want to go with the race card there as well, or the visual, he is a lighter skinned Mexican and redheaded, which that's how he gets his nickname. But also a bigger Mexican fighter too. We don't really see too many Mexican fighters fight past 130 or 140. He's a guy who's a legit 155-pounder, 160-pounder. So seeing him fight at that high of a level is unique. And I think anytime boxing gets good attention, they both seem to be guys who have their heads together. And hopefully they can continue to promote the sport. And I look forward to watching them over the next few years. But I think the fights got overshadowed by all the events that took place this weekend personally. And I don't know how you can alleviate that as far as maybe not fighting on the same weekend as UFC. But UFC fights seems like every weekend, so I don't know if you can alleviate against that. This time of year, playoffs are starting off, and as the NBA and NHL, NFL has a draft. NFL is a 365-day sport anyway. I thought it got kind of lost in the shuffle. But, hey, it's still on TV, and I was able to see him. Last thing I want to talk about is kind of taking a U-turn. We haven't talked a lot of hockey lately, and that's been a kind of a fault of mine. And I've been wanting to get into hockey overall, but I think once the playoffs start, we'll do more analysis of it. What I did see, though, is the Toronto Maple Leafs, who got off to an outstanding start earlier in the season. They've kept it up and are actually going to be in the playoffs for the first time since 2004. And while I was thinking about it, as far as the Maple Leafs, an original six franchise, and how they haven't made the playoffs in close to 10 years, out of all the franchises in the NHL, they have no excuse to be as inept as they have been. They're financially the richest club in the NHL. They're going to become, or just became, the first $1 billion NHL franchise. They play in the biggest Canadian market. They play in Toronto. They have the most money out of anybody. They play in a world-class arena. Probably have the most rabid fan base this side of Detroit or Montreal. And they have not even made the playoffs or the postseason close to 10 seasons. I just don't understand the ineptitude of a franchise. And if you look at it, they've had bad ownership, bad general managership. I mean, you can go down the line and see what's happening with that. But it's good to see the Maple Leafs finally make the playoffs and make the postseason. Now, tying that over to other franchises, I think have new excuses. I look at baseball, and I see the Chicago Cubs, a team that's very similar to Toronto. Old franchise, they have the money, big market. Chicago's now standing sports market. And they've been terrible for close to 70, 80 years, longer than that. They haven't won a World Series in over 100 years. They haven't even been to the World Series to compete for a championship since, I believe, the 40s. So the Cubs have no excuse overall. But I think they're trying to make improvements with Theo Epstein and going from there. Football was a unique one because in football, unlike other sports, there's a salary cap. And everyone should have no excuse, honestly. NBA similar to that. Only sport that really can make excuses for, I guess in a way, is baseball. But even baseball, and I mentioned the Cubs, we've seen teams like Oakland, Tampa, have moments where they have competed at the highest level, competed for world championships, or at least make the postseason, and they have one of the lowest salaries in the entire game. Football is really the one, though, where the rules are meant for you to be competitive in a cycle. Every 3 or 4 years, you should be a playoff team in the NFL. And when you have teams like the Dallas Cowboys, maybe the most known and storied franchise in all of the NFL, or one of the marquee ones, and they have one playoff win since 1997, there's no excuse for that. And even you've seen teams with half of the budget of the Cowboys. We've seen Green Bay have multiple Super Bowls in the past 20 years. The Pittsburgh Steelers, they've won Super Bowls. Even Tampa has won a Super Bowl. And you have teams like the Cowboys, who should be an upper echelon team for years and years, and they've been a major disappointment. And then in basketball, the most obvious one is the New York Knicks. They're finally getting it together, made the playoffs this year, and it looked like they've made finally a good turn. But I think the central figure in all these teams with no excuses as far as they should be an elite team is inept ownership. You can fire a coach, you can trade a player, you can build a new stadium, you can get a new TV deal. But you can't fire an owner. And if you look at the Maple Leafs, the Cubs, the Cowboys, and the Knicks, they've all had bad ownership during the past 15, 20 years. Some of those owners are still there, like Jerry Jones for the Cowboys, and even James Dolan for the Knicks. Some ownerships have changed, like the Maple Leafs changed over the past few years. So I think the central message is, if you have a team that has struggles out there, a lot of people like to look at the general managers and the coaches and the players. Look at the ownership and see why they're, and that's probably why your team is struggling like it is. So while it's good to see the Maple Leafs finally make the postseason and give Canada something to cheer about, it should have happened a lot longer, or it should have happened a lot sooner. And it shouldn't have taken this long for it to happen. Once again, thank you for listening to the Sports Inquirer podcast. We're going to do a show tomorrow. And on that show, we're going to analyze more of the NBA playoffs. We're going to do our Major League Baseball power rankings. And we're also going to probably talk about some racing. So a lot going on the show tomorrow. I've given you all of the information you need. If you want to go to Twitter, Sports Inquirer. Go to our website, thesportsinquirer.net. And finally, send us an email at sportsinquirer@gmail.com. Until then, have a good and safe, productive day out there. Good fight, good night.